afternoon.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And in line with that, here in the Pacific Northwest, it is very, very hot. It has been hot for the last few days. In fact, over the last couple of weeks, we've seen a tremendous amount of hot weather. I think it's wonderful, although it can be very difficult to deal with, especially if you're working outside. So in today's X poll, I'm asking, should the government force all landlords to install air conditioning in all rentals? The city of Portland is considering a policy, and they say we're going to protect residents. How? By adding air conditioning. I'm going to tell you why it may literally rank as one of the most radical air conditioning requirements in the entire United States of America. But if you've lived in the Portland area for very long, you understand they are that crazy. I don't even think that Seattle has gone this far. And you might be surprised to know how much other cities, a few of them around America, actually have air conditioning requirements. But they are limited in ways that would absolutely stun you. I'll get to the details on that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 25-plus years. We're glad to include you in the program. If you want to sound off, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our X poll today. It is hot. Should the government force all landlords to install air conditioning in all rentals? I'd give you a solid no on that. You know what's going to happen? You're going to see landlords say, if I'm going to add this kind of air conditioning to the rental, I'm going to raise the rent, especially if there is no way to meter the electricity and you're effectively allowing unlimited air conditioning. Well, it costs money. Who do you think's going to pay for it, the landlord or the tenant? Well, you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. As I said, Portland is considering this policy. They have not yet done it. The Permitting and Development Department, you know, the folks who basically hold up housing construction, the ones who actually are no favor to anybody who actually wants to build housing, they are looking at a code amendment that would create a maximum indoor temperature standard for rental units and require landlords to install AC or heat pumps in every single one of them. If you think that's a great idea, I'd be glad to take your phone call. You tell me why and whether or not that is going to actually benefit the people who rent those units or not. Now, yesterday's poll, should the government seize any assets of illegal aliens who refuse to self-deport? 89% of you said yes, as did I. 11% of you said no. And on that note, I want to mention one thing. An awful lot of the media in the Northwest in the last couple of days have been making much of the arrest of one illegal alien. And this one is not from south of the border. He is an Iranian illegal alien. He came here on a student visa about 8 years ago. And like so many visa holders, he simply overstayed, meaning that he violated the law and he did not get kicked out. Well, he's getting kicked out now. He was taken into custody. And what seems to be the outrage of most of the people who are being outraged about this is that he dropped his kid off at preschool, and then they took him into custody. Only, you have to take this into account as well. ICE had actually stopped him when he was driving down the street. And he said, well, I have my child here who's going to preschool. Can I drop my child off first? And so ICE said, yes, you can take your child to school, drop the child off at preschool, and then you can give yourself up to us. You know what he did? He dropped his kid off at the Montessori preschool, and then he climbed in his car and he went turtle. He said he would not come out of his car. So that forced ICE to have to break the window of the car. And of course, the tender hearts at the Montessori school were just outraged by this. We can't believe that you do this. What are we supposed to tell the kids? I think it's a teachable moment. You could actually tell the kids at the school, if they say, what happened outside? Why were all those police and law enforcement here? You could say, well, they've arrested a man who's alleged to have violated the law. He'll get a chance to get his due process, although at this point, it sounds like they're going to get an easy order of deportation. Now, his wife is claiming that he's on his way to getting his green card. There's no indication of that I can find with the ICE authorities, but if I do, I'll let you know all about it. Anyway, glad to have you with me and glad to take your calls. Let me tell you about the story that has been bugging me for the last month or so, and it's now getting some national attention. The Federalist and Logan Washburn wrote about it. It's about the fact that Oregon and Washington have motor voter, except that Oregon was found last year to have enrolled people to vote in America, more than 1,000 of them, actually about 1,600 of them, who were, in fact, not legally in the United States, and they were not legal to register to vote. So what did DMV decide to do? They said, let's do an audit. Now, we've talked about this with our friend Jeff Eager before. Jeff is a great journalist. And what did they find? They found what I consider to be stunning evidence. They found that, one, they just took a small sample, and they paid a consulting company about $150,000 to do this, which kind of stuns me. It makes me wonder, how do you get $150,000 for examining the background on 35 voters? Now, there are about 3 million registered voters in the state of Oregon. They sampled just 35 of them. I'm willing to bet that the Democrats kind of rolled the dice because the Democrats call all the shots in Salem just like they do in Olympia. And they said, well, if they check 35 voters, what is the likelihood that they're going to find anybody who is not legally in the United States, or at least not legal to be registered to vote? Fact is, they found one. You say, well, one, Lars, what's the big deal? What is one out of 35? It's 3%. What is 3% of 3 million? Well, that would be about 90,000 voters. So if you're going to say that they paid all that money to have a sample taken and find out how many people do we have registered to vote where there is no proof of citizenship is required to vote, the answer is you could have 90,000 bad voters. Motor voter only covers about a quarter of all the voters in the state, so it would have to be a quarter of that 90,000, or about 18,000 votes. Let me point out to you, there are now people in Salem who are trying to make excuses for motor voter, for vote by mail, for automatic registration and all of that, and they say it's not that big a deal, not enough to actually change the outcome of an election. Really? 18,000 votes in one state is not enough to change the outcome of an election? Why, Chris Dudley, the former trailblazer who ran for governor a few years ago, missed being elected as governor by about 20,000 votes. So 18,000 non-voters registered to vote in the state, I would say that is a major problem. And now the state DMV is trying to hide the results, give them the proper spin, and convince Oregonians, nothing to see here, folks, just a few thousand illegal voters on the Oregon voter rolls. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next, and then I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know he got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Just imagine how much electric power we could enjoy here in the Pacific Northwest if it weren't for Well, the fact that it's illegal to build natural gas power plants. I'm already hearing from customers whose utilities have been warning them to voluntarily conserve electricity or face blackouts later on. Despite that, state officials want everybody in the region, and this is both Oregon and Washington, they want everybody to switch from natural gas, space, and water heat and gasoline cars to electric cars and electric houses at the same time that we're running short of kilowatts. Now, if that makes sense to anybody, I'd love to hear the naysayer explain it. Northwest power planners have guaranteed that the risk of blackouts is going to become much more common in the next 5 years. We've given you the numbers before. And it's no wonder the Northwest has seen the decommissioning of its nuclear plants, the shutdown of coal plants in both Oregon and Washington, and edicts against buying coal power from other states. And then consider the announcement this week from President Trump in the state of Pennsylvania. Joe Biden's war on coal shut down what was known as the Homer City Power Plant. It provided electricity for 2 million homes. It's a big power plant. Well, they shut it down because it runs on evil coal. So now a private company has invested or is investing $15 billion in a brand new natural gas-fired power plant that will produce twice as much electricity as the Homer City Power Plant did and produce it at a very low cost. Now, if you're wondering, well, why don't we have some of those here in the Northwest? Oregon law actually forbids new natural gas-fired power plants. It's illegal. And in Washington state, they haven't quite made it specifically illegal to build plants to make electricity out of natural gas, but try to get one sighted and you'll see what happens. So as the solar and wind jihad continues here in the Northwest, prepare to freeze or sweat in the dark, depending on the season. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. The question came in, Lars, why is the news only talking about Hispanics being taken by ICE? If you get a chance to talk to Tom Homan, he's the point man for ICE and Homeland Security, ask him about the one-sided messaging that the news is doing. Ask about how many people from other countries are being removed. Why do the news shows show people from other countries, Asia, Africa, even Europe being removed? It seems the news is being biased in their coverage. Well, they are. In fact, the example I gave you of the Iranian man who was arrested this week outside of a preschool, a Montessori preschool, he's from Iran. He's not from south of the Rio Grande. He is from Iran. And how did he get here? He came here on a student visa and then just said, yeah, I don't have to do anything else. I'm just going to stay. Visa overstays are one of the biggest problems that they face. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really
presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the Portland Parks Department, and let me tell you why. They have a terrible system right now. They have parks that have about $600 million in backlogged maintenance, which means they're in bad shape. And in many cases in a park, when a park is in bad shape, it means it's not just not fun, it's actually dangerous as well. So, about 6 years ago, they hired a woman named Adina Long. They made her the director of Parks and Recreation. She had been at New York City and their Parks and Rec got better. And then about a month ago, Adina Long was put on administrative leave, only they didn't tell the public why. I don't know if it was misbehavior against her, misbehavior by her, or some other problem, but they put her on administrative leave. Well, now the city has announced she is now leaving her job. And you might say, well, good luck, whatever. Do you know what? They're paying her $140,000 to leave the job. I'd remind you that both Oregon and Washington are states that are called employment at will. That means you can go to work for somebody if you want to, and if they want to hire you. And the day you want to leave, you can stand up and say, boss, I'm giving notice, I'm leaving. You know what? The boss is allowed to do the same kind of thing. I mean, unless he fires you for one of the protected categories like race, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, or gender, He can let you go anytime he wants. You can go anytime you want. That's what employment at will is. She's leaving a job. Now, they're not citing her contract, but they're saying we're going to pay her 6 months' salary to have her walk out the door. Now, I'd also like to know, because the voters and the taxpayers never seem to get the story. You've hired somebody. You paid her almost $300,000 a year, plus she got benefits on top of that. And now that she's been there 5 years, sounds like she might actually qualify for a PERS pension. And if that PERS pension is based on making $285,000 a year to run the Parks Department, and apparently not very well, well, then what's going to happen now? She goes off to her nice PERS pension, and the state writes, or the city writes her, a check for $140,000. I think the taxpayers are owed an explanation, and if they don't get it, they got to fire some people. By the way, today's email of the day, but you can send more to talk at LarsLarson.com, is from Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. Call 855-CAP-THAT or go to CapConcreteCoatings.com. That's CapConcreteCoatings.com. Jim Arter writes in, Lars, it finally happened. The Gateway Fred Meyer is closing, and no surprise. With all the homeless and drug-addicted people that are camped outside of that store, you don't need to explain why you're leaving. We totally understand. You run a business in a city that doesn't care about fixing the drug addict and homeless problem because there's no money, and fixing a problem with only money and pretending to fix things. I don't blame any business in Portland for shutting down, packing their bags, and going elsewhere. I blame the people that keep voting for this moronic leadership. You're going to vote your way into a third world country. Thanks for your time. Signed, Jim Arter. Let me go to Greg. Hey, Greg, it's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. What's on your mind?
Oh, I was calling to talk to you about the power crisis that we have in the Northwest here. So I worked at the hydropowers for over 20 years here on the Columbia River.
Yeah.
And one thing that's real interesting that I've never heard anybody look into is, when these generators break down, they produce about $125,000 a day in revenue.
Yeah.
And when they break down in the last, it's probably been 7 years now, I think, they basically wouldn't let us work on them. We get paid by the hour to be there no matter what for the federal government. And some of these generators would break down, and they've sat there for 7 years at $125,000 a day. And, and my reasoning or my thought behind of it, conspiracy, is basically it's to justify wind and solar, so supply and demand.
That's an interesting point. I'll tell you what, Greg, I'll make a call to BPA and see if we can get an explanation. Do they have unused generators that could be running right now if they were repaired? And if they're not, then why not? And I'll ask the question.
The Lars Larson Show. Actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I want to go back and visit a case that we talked about a number of years ago. There's been a new development involved in this, and it is the Breonna Taylor case. I think this one is much misunderstood by people who don't understand that there was a raid in which a young lady was shot to death. The police had gone after her boyfriend, and now it appears that one of the officers who fired shots that did hit Breonna Taylor did end her life because they were shooting back. Her boyfriend had decided to shoot at the cops as well. She ended up dying. And one of the police officers, while not convicted of the crime of killing her, was convicted of abusing her civil rights. And the question was, how much punishment is he going to get? Well, it turns out he's going to get, I guess, one day in custody, and I don't see the problem with that. Josh Marquis is the former DA, member of the board of the Criminal Justice Truth Project. Hey, Josh, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Lars. And although it's a complicated case, it's not that complicated, because this raid was a completely legitimate raid made based on a search warrant. The young woman was making the terrible mistake of two-timing a known drug dealer and also a regular guy. She was literally going out with both and allowing her house to be used as what's called a stash house for drugs. And the police discovered this, and they did a search warrant, and The good boyfriend happened to be there the night the search warrant was served. And police officers who serve search warrants don't always wear uniforms. They usually have one officer with a uniform. Well, the good boyfriend, for want of a better term, opened fire on the officers, and the officers who were there legitimately executing a legitimate warrant fired back, and Breonna Taylor was killed in the exchange. Now, the local prosecutor declined to charge anything. What happened is the Biden administration jumped in and basically forced filed federal charges against the officer. And now the head of the Civil Rights Division, Harmeet Dhillon, of the Justice of the Trump Justice Department, who I have great admiration for, has stepped in and said, okay, we're going to resolve this one day in jail.
And he's already been in jail for one day. So, in other words, it would be time served. That's a guy by the name of Brett Hankinson. Because, Josh, what do we do in cases like this where you've got the police serving a legitimate warrant? And there was a lot of debate about no-knock warrants and that sort of thing. But at the end of the day,
it was a no-knock warrant.
I know it wasn't, but they used it under the Black Lives Matter banner to say,
right.
You see, we shouldn't have no-knock warrants. They tried to latch that issue onto
exactly. Yes. What
was not a no-knock warrant. And I support the idea of no-knock warrants. They all have to be limited. But the fact is that if the police are going into a dangerous situation, say somebody who is a drug dealer, which this guy, was, or the people. Boyfriend number two was a drug dealer. And are they armed? Yes. Are they dangerous? Might they shoot at the cops? Well, they did. And in that kind of case, should you go up and knock on the door and say, hi, it's the police. Can we come in? And then the bad guy can shoot you to death through the door if he chooses to.
Yeah, and, the details in this case matter. It was, in fact, they had obtained a no-knock warrant. They had decided, even though they didn't have to do a knock nonetheless. And because Ms. Taylor was made the mistake living this double life of having these two boyfriends who obviously didn't really know that much about each other, boyfriend B, when a bunch of armed men show up one night in the black community in Louisville with guns, he not entirely unreasonably thinks something illegal's happening and I'm going to fire back. And this is a tragedy. She should not have died. But for the Biden administration to say, well, we're going to disregard the Louisville district attorney, we're going to disregard the grand jury and what they said, we're going to get us some white heads to put on stakes. And they did. But the Trump Justice Department, I don't agree with everything they do, but this time I think they did a just thing.
And so they've asked for the one day, and I don't know if that's been granted yet or not, but all of this for this conviction from the shooting 5 years ago, it has brought up the question. I'm curious about your take on this, Josh. What happens if somebody is coming into your house? Is the fact that they knocked and announced as they were coming through the door enough to say, at that point, you can't just shoot at people who are coming through your door and call it self-defense?
Well, ironically, I used to get this question more than any other one the 25 years I was district attorney. When can I shoot someone in the middle of the night? And the answer is really the same everywhere, and that is, if you reasonably believed that you were about or your family was about to be the subject of illegal, deadly violence, you have a right to defend yourself. Now, what does that mean? If the police announce themselves, go bang, 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 police officers, here's my badge, then probably you don't, as a homeowner, have a right to return fire. If, on the other hand, none of the people are displaying badges, and there's reason, good reason, for the homeowner to think this is a drug ripoff, they can resist. But what we don't want people doing is exchanging fire if at all we can. And we'd rather just say, wait a minute, let's all chill and call the cops. Now, unfortunately, drug dealers don't follow the rules. But generally, if you are defending your house in good faith, and you have a good faith belief that illegal actions are being taken against your family, you are not going to be prosecuted. For example, let's flip this whole situation around. There's no circumstance in which, let's say, if one of the officers had been killed, even though they'd been serving a warrant, that there would have been criminal charges brought against either the young man who actually fired the shot at the officers or the young woman who was killed, Breonna Taylor.
Because the young man would, his attorney would have said, look, this was a case of self-defense. He legitimately thought that somebody was coming
under
into the house.
Under the circumstances, yeah. He had reasonable belief to believe he was the subject of, you know, violent illegal force. Yeah.
Yeah. And at the end of the day,
what we saw is the Justice Department being politicized by the Biden administration to a point of, you know, we've got to get us a white police officer's head on a pike. And this is what generates so much anger in the law enforcement community nationally. Yeah. Even amongst those of us who don't support Donald Trump.
Well, and for example, Josh, this guy, Brett Hankinson, he has no career at this point, right? He's not going to be a cop, is he?
No, he's not.
No. So in other words, he goes out.
He's going to be sued forever.
He does his job. He does it legitimately. He does it lawfully. He does what is reasonable to fire back. And now he's convicted of a crime. He's got the one day in jail. And even with that kind of good result, which we wouldn't have had from Kamala Harris, you have to admit that Kamala Harris would not have allowed this. Yeah. And so his life is wrecked because he did his job appropriately. And Breonna Taylor was involved in with a guy who was involved in serious criminal violations for drugs.
Correct.
So that just sounds like a dual tragedy. She shouldn't be dead, and he shouldn't be pushed out of policing simply because he did his job. And there's really no way to fix that, is there?
No, there isn't. And I think that what the Trump administration did was a measure of justice and the best thing that could be done.
And by the way, Hankinson was put on trial. He was acquitted in a state trial, and the first federal trial ended in a mistrial. It sounds like they, you know, it's like they just kept going after this guy until they got a conviction.
I mean, when you're the federal government, you have like the resources of God, and nobody can stand up to that if the Justice Department is absolutely intent on wrecking your life.
Josh, I appreciate you taking the time. That's former District Attorney Josh Markey. He's now with the Criminal Justice Truth Project. Glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And, of course, if you're a naysayer, we always put naysayers right to the head of the line. Haven't had a good one yet today, but I'll tell you what, I kind of expect we will. I'll be glad to get to your calls in just a moment. Coming up on the Radio Northwest Network, the city of Portland is considering making air conditioning mandatory in rental homes and apartments. And I want to compare that to some of the other cities that require it. You'll be stunned.
Because you can't get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and our X poll, it is hot. Should the government force all landlords to install air conditioning in all rentals? Well, as you know, most people will tell you how expensive it is to be able to find a rental house or in a rental apartment. So now Portland is considering making it more expensive because they want a new policy that they say protects residents from potentially deadly heat by adding air conditioning requirements for all rental homes and apartments. The Permitting and Development Department is exploring a code amendment to create a maximum indoor temperature standard for rental units, and that would require the landlord to install AC or heat pumps. Well, as you know, that can run from a few hundred to maybe even $10,000 to do that. So I looked around America, and I thought, I wonder how common it is to require air conditioning. Las Vegas requires rental housing to provide air conditioning capable of keeping it at least 70 degrees, no higher, inside an apartment. Dallas has a different one. They require air conditioning that keeps the indoor temperature at least 15 degrees cooler than the outside temperature, with a maximum of 85. So that means that if it's 90 degrees outside, the air conditioning has to at least to bring it from 90 to 75. But if it's 100 degrees outside, the air conditioning only has to pull the temperature down to 85. Tempe, Arizona requires landlords to provide air conditioning or, as they say it, other cooling devices. I would imagine that means a box fan. Montgomery County, Maryland, the East Coast gets hot as well, requires rental units to have AC capable of maintaining no higher temperature than 80 degrees from June through September. New Orleans, about the same AC that would cool bedrooms to at least 80 degrees. And in Phoenix and Tucson, they have ordinances that require AC capable of cooling habitable spaces below 82 degrees. So I wonder if Portland is going to put any limitations on, because if you listen to the usual crowd of greenies that run places like the city of Seattle, city of Portland, state of Oregon, state of Washington, they're going to tell you, people are using too much air conditioning. We're burning up too much power. We're going to overheat the planet. And then all of a sudden they say, why don't we give away free air conditioners to everybody? Or better yet, they've now decided Portland may just tell all the landlords, you have to have air conditioning. If you don't have it, you can't rent your house. You can't rent that apartment. To your calls, 866-439-5277. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a conspiracy theory, but you know, I'm more concerned about who's on the streets, and my concern is violent insurrectionists that burn, loot, and try to kill cops, and then they go before judges that knock them down to misdemeanors that they get expunged in a year and still be able to go out and buy a gun again. So what are we going to do about this judicial tyranny we live under? I mean,
I vote in Washington State, and yes, you vote for judges, and yes, the same kind of fix is in. The judges are ordinarily
Do you vote for those judges, or do you ignore it, or do you write in a candidate?
No, because here's the problem, John. In most places, because of the way the system's set up, judges run unopposed. And I'll tell you why they run unopposed. For most offices in America, you can run for mayor or governor or state legislature or whatever, and you don't have to have any particular profession. But if you're going to run for judge, you have to be a lawyer. Well, that means, and if you have to live in the district where you're running for judge, that means you have to be probably an experienced lawyer who's been working in that area for a while to have some name familiarity. Do you know what happens to your life after you run against a sitting judge and lose? And most people who challenge a sitting judge lose. Guess what happens to your legal career?
Kind of like Russia or China, right?
Well, a bit, but just think about it, John. If somebody runs for mayor and loses, they can go on with whatever their profession is. If they run for city council or they run for the state legislature, it usually doesn't work against them. But in the case of lawyers, if you run against a judge and you...
Man.
Go ahead.
My suggestion is there should be a line that says vote of no confidence, where the judgeship's vacated and they have to come up with two candidates.
Well, except that you know what they do in the meantime? Because the two candidates wouldn't run for another 4 years. What they've done all the way along, and this actually bears explanation, John, is that judges in both Oregon and Washington have a sleazy deal with the governors, because the governors are both Democrats and the judges are mostly liberal, which is why they give no punishment to bad criminals. So the judge gets reelected to a 4-year term. He waits until about the middle of his term and then for no good reason just decides to resign. That gives the governor the ability to appoint the replacement. And why would a judge do that? That's how he got the job to begin with. He was appointed. Then he serves 2 years as a judge. He goes on the ballot as an incumbent. And every lawyer who might run against him knows, if I run against this guy, number one, I'm likely to lose. I'm almost certain to lose. It does happen occasionally, but you're almost guaranteed to lose. And number two, after I lose, having run against a sitting judge, I'm toast as a lawyer in that area. Because the judge and all his buddies don't like it when you run against him. So that is a fix that's in right now. I wish that what we would...
You think the feds will prosecute this gal that just had her charges knocked from a felony at time?
Which gal?
Well, there was a case that was just decided, I think, the last couple of days.
I don't know which one you're talking about, John. Which case? Quick.
I can't think of the name, but...
Okay, John, thank you very much. If you want to reference a case, you got to tell us what it is. Which gal? I mean, what gal? like we're living in a town of 10 people? John, thanks for the call. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday.
The Lars Larson Show.
Call 50.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars
and Now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, happens right here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you first in line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X poll today, it is hot. So should the government force all landlords to install air conditioning in all rentals? I'd say no to the idea. I think that ought to be driven by the marketplace. If landlords in a particular place say, you know, air conditioning's really in demand, but I've decided to go without it, and I'll offer my rentals cheaper than the competition. The competition offers air conditioning. I think it should also be up to you, the consumer. There may be people out there who have air conditioning, and yet, unless it gets really hot or they decide they need to have it on, they leave it turned off. So then you've spent all that money to install air conditioning for people who are not, for the most part, using it at all. And if you consider what it takes to do it, if it is part of a central air system, you're probably talking about $5,000 to $10,000. If you're only talking about window air conditioners, it may be something less than that. But around America, there are a number of places that are either considering adding air conditioning as a requirement or they already have. So you can find the X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, our website. Let me go first to Peggy. Hey, Peggy, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks, Lars. I'm just sitting here trying to get my head around this thing. So I own two homes, one that neither have air conditioning. My family and my children occupy one, and we go without air conditioning. We do box fans, or we go outside and run through the sprinklers. But my rental home, I'm going to be told to put air conditioning in. So I'm going to go without, and my family's going to go out, and my tenant must have air conditioning. I have to provide that for them. They don't have to buy their own portable units, their fans. Next, you're going to tell me I got to buy their kids' diapers. And going back to the whole pre-K thing, I was born at the wrong time. You provide for yourself. My kids, when they need something too, my adult children, if the grandkids need something, they come to me first instead of going to the government and putting their hand out. Or they get a better paying job. So I just,
and I'll bet they get a yes from grandma more often than not, don't they?
Yes. But I'm not going to give my tenant a better situation with this than mine. If I have to buy a box fan and my tenant's getting a decent home, a nice home, and it's Oregon and it's got water and plumbing and electricity, they can choose to get a portable unit. They can choose, just like we all did. I'm not going to install a system and then they don't want to pay their electric bill, like you said, and leave it off. So what was the point? Who's benefiting there? I'm getting spent the money. They're still paying the same rent. They're paying their utilities. They're hot. They're tired. They're cranky. Some of them get dehydrated, pass away. But that was their choice not to turn on the air conditioning either. So how is that going to benefit anybody?
It really doesn't. And Peggy, the other thing you haven't included is you're one landlord. I'm on your side because I've taken the position that if you want to have air conditioning, have it and put it up as a, you know, as a benefit of renting from, you know, this guy. And if you say, I don't need air conditioning, why would I want to pay the extra money? I'll go rent from somebody else. This is the government trying to say, we're going to make all these units equal at equal expense to everybody. And if anybody thinks, oh, this is going to be paid for by the landlord, where do you think the landlord gets the money to pay for all this? He gets it from the tenants. So that means even the tenants who don't use it are going to be forced to pay for it, and I think your argument makes abundant sense. Let's go to Alan. Hey, Alan, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Lars, I'm a long-time listener. I was just hearing all these people who were upset about people being sent out of the country. They were here illegally, and I just wanted to say that in the 50s, I was in the military and went to Germany and married a German girl, brought her back, and then later her only sister married another American and came back to the States. And when my father-in-law passed away, my mother-in-law, Oma, was the only one still left in Germany, and we wanted to get her over here. And the only way we could get her here was on a visitor's visa, which was for 1 year. And that visitor's visa, they made sure that we were notified that her time was up, and she had to go back for 2 weeks and then get another visitor visa. So it took us several years before we could actually get her permanently in this country.
Yeah, and isn't that the way the system ought to work? And, Alan, I think about families like yours that have done that. You've gone through, you've jumped all through the hoops, you've paid the money, you've taken the inconvenience of it, and you did it the right way. And then there's a bunch of people saying, ah, I don't wait for that. To me, Alan, they're just like line cutters or line jumpers. You know, you go out and you're standing there in line for a concert or a ball game or a movie or whatever it happens to be. And how do most Americans react when they see somebody cutting in line, whether it's on the highway or waiting at a store or at a business to get in, and everybody else has stood patiently in line, and somebody comes along and says, I don't have to stand in line. I'm going to cut ahead of all these people. I know that most people don't take that very lightly. They say, get back in line. Get to the back of the line.
I'm afraid I do that.
Well, and I do it too, and frankly, you know, I'll be at a store and I'll look around and I'll say to the person I'm about to stand behind, is this the end of the line? And they'll say, yeah, you're the last person. I say, okay, I just want to make sure that I'm not, because sometimes the lines kind of wind around and you can't tell where the end of it is. But the idea that there are groups of people in America who say, oh no, you should be able to jump the line. Well, then why doesn't everybody just jump the line? In fact, there's a story most recently about a lady who went up to the Canadian border with her family, and apparently she's now accused by the Border Patrol of trying to smuggle people into the United States. And it sounds like they might actually have a pretty good case. She's been in custody for a few weeks now. But imagine this, that there are Americans who say, we're going to cut in line. And I'll tell you, maybe part of what colors my point of view on this, Alan, I've told people before, I was born in Taiwan because my mom and dad were both in the U.S. Navy. My dad was still in at that point. He was serving in Taiwan on a U.S. base, and that's where I was born. But when we came back, there was a guy who had helped my mom out. We, you know, my dad and mom hired him to help her out while she had a brand new baby, me, and I'm sure I was all kinds of trouble. So they hired him. His name was Joseph Koo. And for the longest time, every year, we'd throw money in a jar and eventually be, you know, my mom would turn it into a money order and we'd send it to him. And she kept working at this end and he was working at that end to try to legally immigrate in America. And I remember my mom died when I was 10, so I have vague memories of this, but I'd say, why can't Joseph just come here? And she said, no, you have to go through this process. Now, this was in the early 1960s. And so, you know, thinking about it now, if you take the approach of all these people who don't seem to think that the laws apply to them, she could have just said, I'm going to buy him a ticket to fly to Canada. We'll drive up to Canada, put him in the car, and drive him back across the border. And then he'll just live here without any real status here. But he'll have been here long enough. And then you'd make the argument that so many of these illegal alien families are making. They're saying, well, dad or mom has been here for 10 years. Doesn't that mean they get to stay? And my answer to that is always, if you catch the guy who's been embezzling from the bank for 10 years and he says, I've gotten accustomed to all this extra income from my embezzlement. I've been doing it for 10 years. You've got to let me keep on embezzling. That argument doesn't fly. Alan, thanks for the call. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Email talk@LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And there isn't a better conspiracy theory than the fact that there is now a full-blown communist who is the Democrat nominee for mayor of New York City. And in fact, he is, according to the pollsters, the odds-on favorite to win in the November election. His name is Zohran Mamdani, and I want to talk about him in a moment. But first, I want to get a naysayer. And I take it that, Brandon, you heard me talking about today's X poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day today. Should the owners of rental housing have to install air conditioning for all? There are a number of cities that already require it. There are more that are considering making this a requirement, saying you got to put air conditioning in that unit, in that apartment or house, and if you don't, then you can't rent it. You're a naysayer on that?
Yes, sir, I am.
Why?
I believe that the prices are reflecting competition, but not quality. All of the apartment buildings in, say, Clackamas, most of them have been built from the 1970s and 80s. And the prices of the new ones that were built last century, they're the same. The older ones don't have heat. They have baseboard heating and no AC. So why should they get the same price as the ones with AC?
Supply and demand.
Right now it's because of demand. Exactly.
No, it's demand. Because of demand. Except that even within that demand, Brandon, you're telling me that prospective tenants don't go out and they say, I'm looking for a place to live. I need an apartment, two bedrooms, etc. They go out and they look at a unit. And they say, ah, this looks kind of old and decrepit. And then they go look at another one and they end up renting the one that is the better unit for whatever they can buy from it. Until there's enough supply, as long as there's a lack of supply, then demand is always going to exceed supply, and it means that all of them will end up being rented pretty much at whatever price the landlord wants to charge. Isn't that the case?
Yes, sir, I agree. So if they're going to charge high for old stuff that doesn't have quite the amenities that the new stuff does, and all of these corporations own pretty much most of the rental market, there's a few
Actually, Brandon, you're wrong about that, because the majority of rental housing in America is owned by what you call mom and pops. And we've talked about this 100 times. I mean, there's a perception. BlackRock, they own everything. No, they own about 5% of America's rental market. Not everything, but 5%. And the bulk of the rental housing in America is owned by mom and pop, you know, couples that have gone out and bought a house or two or three or have a little apartment building. And that's what the actual marketplace is if you look at who owns it.
Okay, well, and even if that's the case, until we get more supply or at least equaled out somehow, I mean, houses in the 1930s should not rent the same as a house from the 2000s.
Well, I think you're mistaken when you say they rent the same. It's if people are looking for a place to live and they can't find anything else, they're going to rent whatever they can rent. But it's still
right,
the market. The market. Yeah, but consider this: when you say until we get enough supply, Brandon, have you thought about what requiring air conditioning means? It means that everybody who's considering building any new housing to rent, like apartment buildings, duplexes, even individual rental houses, is saying, now we've got to factor in air conditioning at $5,000 or $10,000 to put air conditioning into a house. So if you're trying to get people to build more of it, and then you put requirements on that make it more expensive to build it, do you think you'll get more rental housing or less?
Less, but hopefully we transition into home ownership, not rentals. And
well,
the $5,000 to $10,000 is a drop in the bucket comparatively to the price of a new house.
Well, except, Brandon, we're not talking they can sell you a house that doesn't have air conditioning in it. But what they want to say is, but if you want to rent a house, it has to have air conditioning. And when you say transition to home ownership, you're talking about the individual. I'm talking about the whole marketplace. And this is the way it splits. 61 or 62% of people in America own their house. The other 40%, that number doesn't change that much. I think when home ownership was the highest, it might have gone to 66% ownership and 34% rent. And these days it's more like 61 or 62, but the number doesn't change much. It's basically 3-2. You know, for every three units that are owned, two units are rented. And that number has not changed dramatically in a long, long time. So somebody, 40% of America is going to rent its housing, you know, for the foreseeable future. That's not going to change. And if you think, well, no, one day 90% will own their house. I don't think we've ever been within any range of 90%. So if you tell the people who build rental housing, some company that says, we're thinking of throwing up an apartment building, 50 units, and you say, okay, we just added $5,000 or $10,000 to the cost of each unit. You realize that just like individuals, companies are going to look at that and say, no, that doesn't pencil out. Sorry, we're not going to do it.
I don't think they're going to. I think they're going to say, okay, we're just going to charge a little bit more and it'll all be
No. But Brandon, you think
electricity, at some point we had to have this in the turn of the century where I'm not adding wires to this house for electric light bulbs.
Probably true, but Brandon, you don't think that companies make the same kind of decisions that you do? Where you used to go to a place to buy sandwiches and they were $7.50 and you walked in one day and it was $8.50 and you said, I ain't paying $8.50 and you walked out the door. Everybody does that. Every company does that. So when a company is told we're adding $5,000 or $10,000 in air conditioning costs to the apartment, but boss, in that marketplace, we can't bump the rent much higher than where we're at right now. So we're not going to be able to recover that cost. So your return on investment just went down. It's no different. So when the company says our ROI went from 4.5 to 4, we're not doing the project. Just like you might say, if I've walked in and I'm going to buy a new car and they say, well, the interest rate just went from 8% to 9%. You said, no, I'm not paying that. Companies do that too. And for good reason.
Well, I understand that, but the prices are not matching the quality and there's no reason to not add AC. They're not going to stop over $5,000, $10,000 AC.
No reason. So if you owned a rental, you'd be okay with dropping another $10,000 into it knowing you will never get it back in the rent?
Yeah, because I've decided to own a rental. I know that I'm going to get...
He just dropped an F-bomb, folks. Dump, dump, dump. Sorry about that, Brandon. When you drop swear words, I can't afford to pay the FCC, and I can't raise my prices. Let's go to Charles in Beaverton. Hey, Charles, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey there, Lars. I just wanted to ask you a quick few questions here. Is it possible to have 36 PSI, 36 pounds per square inch of air pressure around the rim of a car without the tire?
No, but I know you're leading somewhere, but you're going to take all your time. Why don't you make the point you're trying to make?
Well, the second question is it possible to have gas pressure without a container?
Yes.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, how? Has anyone ever demonstrated that?
Gravity. Gravity is one of the things that holds. Is it possible for me to put water in a bucket and turn it upside down without the water falling out? Sure. Put it on a rope, swing it over your head. The water will be going sideways, but it will not fall down. And you know why? That's called centrifugal force. And gravity does the same kind of thing. I know what he's trying to lead to is he's one of those people who believes that Earth lives in some kind of Petri jar or some kind of, a giant pickle jar, and that's what's keeping the air in. It couldn't possibly be gravity from a giant planet that has a fair amount of gravity associated with it. Charles, if that was what you were trying to get to, you're not going to get there that way. And go out and try the centrifugal force experiment. You'll watch water stand up.
The Lars Larson Show. Right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails, and I'll do that in just a moment. But first, I want to talk about the price of tomatoes and whether or not various costs, including tariffs and other factors, are going to affect that. Mike Kucharski joins me now. He's the owner of JKC Trucking, which is a rather large trucking company. Hey, Mike, welcome back to the program.
Lars, thanks for having me on your show again.
So tell me about this. The U.S. government announced 3 days ago that it is immediately placing a 17% duty or tariff on the most fresh Mexican tomatoes, on most of them, after negotiations ended without an agreement to avert that tariff. Are we going to see an increase, or are we just going to see more American-grown tomatoes to take the place of the Mexican-grown tomatoes?
Yes, and the yes could go multiple different ways, but what this move signals a broader emphasis on protecting domestic producers, as you said, from perceived unfair competition. And what I mean by this is there's two sides. There's the U.S. agriculture that's selling tomatoes, and then the Mexican agriculture, and it depends who you ask the answer you're getting. So the U.S. domestic tomato growers, particularly in states like Florida, California, Arizona, are largely supportive of this tariff. You know, they argue it levels the playing field against Mexican competitors who benefit from year-round production, lower labor costs, and what they claim are subsidized or dumped goods that have flooded the U.S. market. They can't keep up with price because they're selling it at a cheaper price. And what they're saying is they're anticipated, you know, and it depends who you ask. If you're asked Americans, they're saying the U.S. agricultural, they're saying anticipated consumer prices vary by source and could increase from range from 7 to 13%. But this is the interesting part. If you ask the Mexican agriculture, they're saying that it's going to be 50% analysis from the Mexican agricultural groups, which is very curious. And what you said earlier, yes, you know, I think this is to push more domestically grown tomatoes here in the U.S. because we've gotten too comfortable buying cheaper products from other countries.
Yep. And by the way, Mike, it stunned me. I would plead, I guess I'd ask forgiveness of my audience. I only found out about maybe a year ago when somebody said, do you know that America is a net food importer? And I remember expressing surprise and saying, hold on a second. We know how to grow things better than just about anybody else on earth. How is it that we are a net food importer? And just as you said, it's because we got fat and happy and said, yeah, we could grow tomatoes, but let's let them be grown somewhere else. Except I think there's a real health deficit to buying the foods overseas because America is so particular about everything, about water, about contamination, about use of chemicals, about use of pesticides and herbicides and all that. And I don't, that's never been one of my big issues, but I want to make sure that when I get an apple, even if it's an American grown apple, I wash it off. You know, I try to choose carefully. If it's full of worms, I'm going to dump it in the trash. But I want to buy stuff that's good. And when Americans say, oh, we care all about the FDA has to watch, you know, what kind of food coloring is used in, you know, in drinks or in Fruit Loops and things like that. And you say, but we're buying tomatoes from Mexico on which may have been used herbicides, pesticides and fertilizers that are not even allowed to be used in America. I think this is actually a benefit in more than just getting more Americans growing tomatoes. It's about getting our food supply so that we know what's going into it.
No, you have a valid point there. And just to give you an idea, the U.S. grows a lot of produce. Just to give you the from spring to fall, just California by itself supplies 80% of the produce in the U.S. It just shows you how a massive player California by itself is. That's not including Arizona and other countries. So the only time that we go into Mexico and really buy a lot, and at one point, when you look up stats, it says 67% of tomatoes are brought into the U.S. But that is only in the winter months when we cannot grow it here. But, you know, we do have greenhouses also that we could grow a product all year. I remember going to a greenhouse in Romulus, Michigan. They were growing tomatoes for Canada.
And what, there's snow? Is there snow piled up outside the greenhouse, but they're still growing tomatoes inside because they heat it or what?
Yeah, it was just a massive building. They were just growing multiple levels of tomatoes and houses. There's multiple of these greenhouses. North Carolina has one. California has one. How do you think California grows strawberries all year long? They have a greenhouse. That's how we do it. And this would just, you know, push more domestic product. You know, this could boost domestic production with an analysis suggesting the U.S. might need to expand tomato acreage by 42,000 to up to 250,000 acres to offset reduced imports. You know, this potential will create jobs and stabilize rural economies. And the most important thing that I like to always go back to is, you know, when we shut down for COVID, we really hurt ourselves. We really showed how much we rely on the rest of the world. You know, God forbid another pandemic happen, a war, etc., act of God. I would feel much better having most of the product here. And then if you're also a person that, you know, believes in global warming or wants
less carbon footprint, then it will only be better to grow these tomatoes and more produce in the U.S. because we will use less energy, use less diesel, use everything less to provide the same
Well, I'm talking to Mike Kucharski, who's owner of JKC Trucking. Mike, the number that really brought it home to me, 20 years ago, 70% of the tomatoes in the U.S. market, for example, came from American farms. Now, that goes from 70% 20 years ago to 30% today. So we've dropped 40% of our supply in 20 years. That means we've just had this steady erosion. You know, if you do what my geometry teacher always told me to do, 2 points make a line. Take those 2 points, yep. 70% two decades ago, 30% today. Mike, how many years till we end up at zero production in America and we're 100% dependent on some other country for produce like tomatoes?
No, I agree. If we continue down this downward spiral, we might just, you know, be controlled. We might just have to beg Mexico for produce, especially during the winter months, or you know, import produce from around the world, which is going to be astronomical prices. Yeah, it's a slippery slope, and we came too dependent on this. You know, I support the U.S. farmers, and America has so much farmland to offer. Honestly, if we really wanted to, we could grow 100% of produce all here. If we buckled down, it wouldn't be a problem. This would be, well, this could be done. Would it be done overnight? No, but it could be done.
Well, I'll tell you one of the things I've got in mind, and that is I don't like subsidies on anything. I don't like subsidies on Teslas. I don't like subsidies on farming. So if the farmer says, well, I can barely make it, you're going to have to subsidize my operations. I'll tell you what. We say, well, guess what? We need somebody to grow tomatoes. So you grow tomatoes. You'll make enough money there. You won't need to have subsidies from us. You know, stop all the ethanol subsidies because of corn growing and things like that. But say, if we have a demand in America to buy, to produce American produce, then we don't need to pay people not to farm or not to put crops on acreage. And we can do two things at once, end the subsidies and have much more of our food grown in America. And at that point, when you say to Americans, you're going to pay less in subsidies, then it's going to be worth 17% more to go and buy fresh tomatoes that are American-grown tomatoes. Make tomatoes great again. Hey, Mike, thanks very much. That's Mike Kucharski from JKC Trucking. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. The X poll question today has to do with air conditioning. Should the government tell all landlords you must install air conditioning or you don't rent that house or apartment? I would say no to it. You can vote any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show. If
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, I promised to talk to you about Comrade Mom Donnie. I'm going to do that now. I didn't tell Joel, but I'm telling him now. We got to say at least a couple of things about Comrade Mamdani. That is Zohran Mamdani, the guy who got the Democrat Party nomination for mayor of New York. He's also the Democrat Socialist Party nominee as well. And this guy is just like six kinds of lunatic. Let me play the first soundbite where he talks about abolishing the ownership of private property.
My platform is that every single person should have housing. And I think faced with these two options, the system has hundreds of thousands of people unhoused, right? For what? And if there was any system that could guarantee each person housing, whether you call it the abolition of private property or you call it, you know, just a statewide housing guarantee, it is preferable to what is going on right now.
Now, imagine this. This guy is saying he would abolish private property or have some kind of state system, which means the state would end up owning your property. Anytime this guy tries to deny that he's a communist, that's exactly what he's talking about. And what he leaves out is, say, New York City maybe has a couple hundred thousand people who are not housed. If you want to give him that big a number, I suspect it's lower. Los Angeles, the second biggest city in America, has about, I think the current number of homeless is about 60,000. What he ignores is that they have literally millions of people who are housed. And in New York City, at some of the highest housing costs in America. Now, I'm sure the people in New York would like to have housing costs less. But the fact is that 60% of the people own a house. The other 40% rent a house, and a tiny, tiny fraction of people are not housed. And he's going to solve that by taking away private property ownership and then somehow reassigning it some way. And yet the Democrats seem to love this guy. For example, Democrat Congresswoman Luz Rivas, she absolutely loves the way the guy talks.
He talked about, you know, freezing rent, faster buses in New York City, and universal child care, which seems to be the message that really resonated with New York City voters.
Oh, I love the way he talks and all these big ideas. And then the same congresswoman a moment later is asked, have you heard about his idea for government-owned grocery stores, and how would that actually work?
I'm not sure how that would work. I haven't really looked at how that would work.
Yeah, so in other words, he talks real pretty. He sure do got a pretty mouth. Except that even the folks who think that's fantastic have absolutely no idea how any of this would actually be accomplished. And I don't want you to put this image in your mind. Imagine a government-run grocery store. Now, right now, you've got your choice of all the private sector grocery stores wherever you happen to live, whether it's Seattle, Portland, Spokane. You can go to Rosar's, you can go to QFC, you can go to Fred Meyer, Winco, or Safeway, or any of the above. And when you're unhappy with one, you can try another one. Now, imagine that the government runs the grocery stores, and you say, how long would the private sector grocery stores stay in business when they face competition from, number one, a government agency with deep pockets, and number two, Mamdani has promised we will charge less for our products than the private sector grocery stores charge. So in other words, it's going to be a money-losing operation. If you did that as a private sector company, if you said, I'm so rich, I'm going to come in and buy a grocery store, I'm going to sell groceries lower than everybody else who has a grocery store there, what happens to all the other grocery stores? They lose all their customers to you, and you go out of business. That would be called a monopoly. Give the government the monopoly, and then have it run by the same people who run the DMV, the USPS, and Amtrak. Good grief. Let's go to a Weldon in Richmond. Hey, Weldon, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
That's Redmond.
Redmond, Washington. There's two of them in the Northwest, so go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, no problem. I think this air conditioning thing is even wilder and crazier than you're describing.
Okay.
Because right now we're having, like, a heat wave in Washington, and they've already asked people not to use your AC or turn it down. Now you're talking about doubling, possibly, the amount of people who have AC. And then the power grid cannot handle it. It'll cause rolling blackouts, and nobody will have AC.
I think that's what they may be aiming at. And Weldon, can I give you another factor that I can't quantify, but I think it bears on this. What happens when somebody in Oregon or Washington says, I don't have the money to pay my power bill? Do they get rescued? Yes.
If you're an illegal immigrant, yeah, you get rescued.
Well, not just American illegal aliens, but also poor people in Oregon and Washington have special programs that give them forgiveness of their power bill. The government comes in and pays part of their power bill. Now, Weldon, if somebody else is paying a big chunk of your power bill, do you care how low that air conditioner gets turned?
Oh, no, you're going to keep it going full blast no matter what happens.
You're going to turn your living room into a meat locker. Whereas the person who actually has to pay the power bill, I pay our power bill. And believe me, I watch what that thermostat is set at, not just in July, but also in January. Because I'm aware if I turn the heat up, it's going to cost more. If I turn the heat down in the summertime, it's going to cost more. But for the people they're talking about benefiting, these are the folks that all these Energy Trust of Oregon and a similar organization, Washington, they say, we want to give free air conditioners to people who are poor. Really? You're going to give them a free air conditioner, and then we're going to pay their power bill on top of that, and you're going to conserve energy by doing that, and then you're going to tell all the people who actually pay their own power bill, please turn off your air conditioner. We've got to save the power for all the poor people with air conditioners. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday.
The Lars Larson Show.
It's over. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars and now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Our X-Poll question today. It is hot. Should the government force all landlords to install air conditioning in all rentals? Various cities around America have done one thing or the other. You can find the question. I'm going to vote no. I don't want the landlords to be forced to do that. I used to be a landlord. I'm no longer. I haven't rented a house in some time, but I think it makes no sense for the government to specify what kind of conditions you should have in that house. But you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. So if the American Medical Association is all for illegal aliens to be on Medicaid, why are they against recouping the cost from a recipient's estate when the circumstances merit that? I thought we'd talk about that with Elizabeth New, who is a research analyst and director of the Center for Worker Rights and Healthcare at Washington Policy. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Hello, Lars.
I don't know. We might find ourselves on opposite sides of this one. I'm not sure where you are yet. But the AMA, the American Medical Association, which I think represents about 20% of doctors at most, has voted to oppose a federal requirement that says states have to seek to recover long-term care Medicaid costs from the estates of people who've died. What's going on there?
Yeah, the AMA just voted to oppose this requirement that I think has been on the books since 1993. And, you know, opposing it was interesting. Not only should the government, who pays for years of costly care for someone, when the person leaves behind a sizable estate, it's totally fair for taxpayers to ask for repayment and to preserve that safety net for people in need. But even with the federal requirement, you know, the AMA voting to oppose makes it sound like the states are doing a good job with this. They are not. Most states are recouping little to nothing. I saw an HHS study that showed 5% or fewer of recipients' estates were even pursued in Washington state. And the Department of Social and Health Services told me this week that in fiscal year 2025, this year, Washington recovered just 0.34% of more than $5 billion spent in Washington state for Medicaid long-term care services.
Now, am I right in suspecting that's a choice by the states? Because not everybody who dies leaves behind much, you know, much in their estate. They might have some money in a bank. They might have a piece of property. They might have a vehicle. But for those who do, if they leave behind, let's say, a house or some other assets, is it wrong if the government has paid, I don't know, tens of thousands or even $100,000 on their long-term care at the end? Is it wrong to say we'd like to get the money back as much as we can so that we, you know, keep our system of providing that kind of care in good shape?
Well, I think estate recovery is absolutely necessary if you're going to have a safety net program like this. And I think it should be coupled with different eligibility. Right now, for example, in Washington State, you can have a home worth more than $1 million and qualify for Medicaid long-term care. And I think, you know, that's fine if you want to set up an agreement that says after you pass away, after your dependents, you know, strict dependents aren't using the home anymore, that money is, some of that money is recovered by the state. But we're not doing that. We don't have eligibility that makes sense. We don't have agreements up front that make sense. And then you hear the argument that trying to recover money from these estates is too costly, and it only hits the poor.
Well, hold on. But Elizabeth, how could it be too costly? Because help me walk through this. If you have somebody in your family who's on Medicaid, and it may be a senior, because as I understand it, there are some seniors
right.
who are both on Medicare and Medicaid, and say mom or grandma lives in a house, the house is worth a couple, three, you know, if they're in the Pacific Northwest, the house, if it's owned free and clear, is likely to be worth a few hundred thousand dollars. And mom gets, say, $50,000 in care from Medicaid, in her last few months or last few years. And the state comes along and simply adds itself to the list of all the other people who are creditors on an estate. I mean, whether people know it or not, if and when you die, whether you die expected, you know, if you knew that your demise was nigh or not, the folks you owe rent to are going to collect it. The credit cards you still owe money to, they're going to collect from your estate. I mean, there are lots of players that will collect from a dead person's estate. And whatever's left over goes to presumably the kids or whatever charity you've decided to leave it to. The only people who get, you know, the person who's getting the Medicaid help doesn't get hurt. It's only the survivors who say, ah, I thought I was going to get 50 grand from grandma, and now I'm only going to get 30 grand because some of it went for her care. I really have a tough time with people saying, well, they shouldn't take that money. Well, who should pay it? Your fellow right. taxpayers?
You're exactly right. You know, and there are waivers available. Let's say that grandma dies in a nursing home. She's received tons of money from the government, from taxpayers, and there's still a spouse living in that home. There are waivers. The spouse can keep living in that home. Dependents can keep living in that home. This isn't about kicking anyone out on the street from a home that was occupied. This is about after death, recouping some of the cost. And what we're talking about here is only the long-term, I'm talking about the long-term services provided to people in Medicaid. Medicaid is the primary payer for long-term care in Washington State and everywhere else because the eligibility is so loose that people who are not in need of taxpayer dependency are going on Medicaid long-term care, leaving their assets to be inherited by their offspring or relatives, and expecting taxpayers to pick up the bill for their long-term care.
I'm sure I'm going to get some naysayer calls on this because, Elizabeth, I know there are people who've gone through this, and they all looked at, and I guess what I don't like about it is if they looked at grandma's, and when she's gone, I get her million-dollar house, or and when she's gone, I get her three automobiles, you know, and they think that way, and then they say, you mean we have to actually pay for her care? Yeah. Because the alternative is telling every other taxpayer in the state that you're going to pay for her care so her kids can get the free and clear million-dollar house or three automobiles or the rest of her bank account or whatever. So it'd be interesting to find out if there's any paper trail within the state bureaucracy where they said, no, don't pursue that stuff at all. Because you can better believe that every other creditor of that person, everybody they've owed, that they currently owe money to, they're going to collect at the end. And it all happens after the person has passed. So it's not as though, you know, you've got men with guns at the front door banging on the door trying to take money right. from a little old lady. They're coming to say, no, I'm sorry, your kids don't get all that money because we have to take care of your care. That is Elizabeth New, who's a research analyst. She is the director of the Center for Worker Rights and Healthcare at Washington Policy. In a moment, I'll get you your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And Democrats say illegal workers take jobs Americans don't want, but are companies just choosing cheaper foreign labor through H-1 and H-2A visas?
political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I have a feeling that we're going to see some real adjustments in the months and years ahead about the way that America uses imported labor. And I don't just mean illegal aliens. I mean things like H-2A B visa or H-2A visas. And here's why. The Department of Justice has now brought an action against a Mississippi company for favoring foreign workers on H-2A visas over American job applicants. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from people who say, I tried to get a job with that company. I went down. I told them I have the skills and talents and abilities to do it. And they hired all foreign workers anyway. This week, the DOJ has announced a settlement agreement with a Mississippi firm that specialized in funneling foreign H-2A visa workers into U.S. farms after they found that Americans had applied for the jobs. American workers seeking jobs in their own country deserve priority. That's what the law says. That's what the Attorney General says. This Department of Justice, she says, will continue to protect our country's workers from unlawful discrimination. I understand that if there are companies that say we can't find the skills and talents that we need to fill these jobs, let us fill them with foreign applicants. That's one thing. But the law also says you have to offer those jobs to the Americans who have the skills and talents, even if the foreign workers would be cheaper. I'm glad to see the Trump administration go that way. Let's go first to Matt. Hey, Matt, welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, how you doing? Hey,
quite well.
So I see all these people out there, you know, they're on welfare. They've got 20 kids, five, six, seven kids. And then they do their taxes at the end of the year. They have been getting free housing. They have been getting free food stamps, free, you know, all the stuff from the schools, lunches and all that stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, they can get back like $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 back.
Yes, they can.
And they're thinking about these old people out here working and stuff. So how does that work out? I think they should say, hey, if you're going to get $10,000 back, we're going to go dollar for dollar. Anything left over that you didn't borrow from us to live with your family, you'll get the rest of that back, but not until you paid. I raised 10 kids. I've never been on welfare in my life. I'm not even close to a rich guy whatsoever. We just raised 10 kids, paid for school lunches, did all that stuff. Things were tight, but we did it. We have never.
And good for you. And by the way, Matt, what you're talking about is that it's called the earned income tax credit. It's basically negative income tax. That's another idea that economists have floated over the decades. I think even the great Milton Friedman, who I agree with, he's not around anymore, but I agreed with him about a lot of things. I did not agree with negative income tax. That's the idea that if you don't make much money, the government will make up some of the difference by paying you some money. So somebody who owes zero in taxes at the end of the year may end up getting back a bunch of money through the EITC. And it's one of the biggest scams you've ever seen, because in a lot of ways, Matt, let's say you start out and you said, my goal is to get to a household income of 80 grand. And you say, but I only make 60. And the government says, hey, we'll make up the other 20. What incentive do you have to try to better your skills and abilities and position to get to that 80 if the government says we'll make up the difference?
Right. Yeah, they don't.
If you don't change that earned income tax credit, it is not going to change. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who have found ways to skim or scam the earned income tax credit. They'll claim kids they don't have, kids that live in a foreign country, and they get the EITC. It has been a scam for a long, long time. Let's go to Tom. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I guess I only have one question on this Medicare. You know, Social Security, I paid into Social Security, and when I retire and it's appropriate, I get that money back, but I put it in. That's my money. The question is on Medicare, did I put money into Medicare that I should be able to get back to?
You have put money in. I'm trying to remember the particular thing on the payroll tax that pays Medicare, but Medicare right now is upside down. And in fact, they're due to run out of money in the next few years, and they'll have to cut the benefits dramatically. And they're already kind of pathetic benefits anyway, because when you go to the doctor and the doctor charge, let's say the doctor charge you $100 for a visit, I know none of them are that cheap. Medicare might pay the doctor $70 for your visit to the doctor, as that means he either eats the rest or passes on the cost to everybody else. So, yes, you've paid into Medicare. Is there enough money in there to pay the benefits that everybody is being promised? No, the money ain't there.
Well, I you know, back to the same old story. You know, I agree with you that their assets should pay for the long-term health benefits that the old folks got. But if they already paid into it, they ought to be able to get that much back out.
Well, don't mix two things up. You said Medicare, that's for the elderly. We were talking about Medicaid, that's for the poor. Oh. So Medicaid is health insurance for the poor people in America. Now, sometimes there are people who get both Medicaid and Medicare, meaning you're elderly and poor, and you get Medicaid and Medicare and mix them together. But we were talking specifically about Medicaid. So imagine this, Tom. A guy owns a house. Maybe he doesn't own it outright, but he's got some equity in it. And then something happens, and he ends up hurt in an accident, or in some way he's in long-term care, and then he dies while he's in long-term care. If Medicaid has paid, say, $30,000 worth of that care, just for a number, but his house is worth $100,000 more than he owes it, should his family have to pay for the care that was provided, or should other taxpayers pay for it?
So the question is, did he pay into Medicaid?
Well, all of us pay into Medicaid, but it's welfare. It's insurance for the poor.
I guess from my point of view, I'm happy to give part of my wage every day to the poor and the people who get in accidents and stuff like that. That's just part of my my tax to the community, I guess.
Even if a guy has a $1 million house?
No, I'm paying for that, which means if I get hurt, or if I'm an old folk and I got to retire, and I end up tipping over and all my assets go to my kids, that the assets would pay off my whatever it costs to house me.
Yeah, your final care. I am too. What Elizabeth New was questioning is, why is it that when the federal law says they're supposed to pursue a payback, and she said literally you could be on Medicaid as an older person and have a $1 million home that you owe free and clear, but it's not income. It's just value of that piece of property. When you die, it goes to your kids. They can sell it. They can live in it. They can do whatever. They can borrow money against it. And the question is, should the state of Washington or the state of Oregon go after some of that to pay for the last couple of years of your care and long-term care if it was paid for by Medicaid? The law says they should.
I think they should, but I'm going to just caution you here, because what happens on all this health care stuff is it might cost $100,000 to house someone, but they end up getting billed $200,000. So, we all know how that goes. So I would say, to the extent that it is, someone needs to look at it smarter than me and say, you know, what would be reasonable? Maybe it's a percentage of it. But I do agree that the assets...
Because remember, whatever you don't pay is going to be paid for by your fellow taxpayers, and try to figure if that's fair. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland. Wise words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I would swear that if the United States Congress behaves a lot like many of us, and I guess I'd have to count myself in that group. Back in high school, you get a 20-page assignment to write, and you get the assignment about 3 weeks or 4 weeks before it was due. And then on the Sunday night before you actually had to deliver it the next morning, you're sitting there cranking out the last 15 pages. At least that's the way the Congress seems to me. I don't know if Paul Mueller sees it the same way. He is an economist with the American Institute for Economic Research. And Paul, what I'm wondering at this point is, Is this thing going to get through the House and Senate by the deadline tomorrow at noon?
Well, I think the odds are good. You know, the House has already passed a version of this bill, and the Senate passed basically the same thing, but with a slightly smaller, but still substantially the same bill. So we'll see. You know, Mike Johnson has to pull out some of his magic again. He's done some incredible things with almost no majority. So I'm hopeful that they will get this done by tomorrow.
Why do they always run everything to the 11th hour? Do you have any idea?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I don't know the inner workings inside and out, but it's one of those things of human nature you referred to, that unless we have a strong motive to get something done, we tend to procrastinate. And, you know, Congress is dealing with a lot of different things right now. They're trying to get different appropriations bills worked up for the coming fiscal year. And then, you know, they have all their procedural issues. It would be nice if they were more on top of the ball. I think Mike Johnson's running a tight ship, but it seems like things do often come down to the 11th hour, like you mentioned.
I guess the thing that troubles me is that I was told, well, if this one passes, then it's indicative that they could probably get another rescissions bill through. And if it doesn't pass, well, then it's game over and they're just going to give up on trying. Well, this one, as you said, looks likely to pass, cut $9 billion out of a budget that's $2,000 billion beyond its revenue, which means it's a start. It's the first step in a long journey. But then I'm told, oh yeah, the next rescissions package will probably come next year sometime. And I thought, hold on, you just had this one get through. You cut nine. Can you get in there and cut a little bit more? I would think that, you know, most individuals listening to this show right now, if they knew that they were up against it financially, I would think that they would sit down with their family and say, hey, we got to make some cuts here. You know, dad's paycheck is smaller, mom's paycheck is smaller, and we got to make cuts. And if the kids said, yeah, let's discuss those in the spring, I think mom and dad would say, no, it has to be talked about now. Except that the Congress says, hey, we're anxious to go on vacation, so we're going to get out the door if we can.
Well, I understand that sentiment. I think we all wish that that was how it operated. But you have to remember that our deliberative process requires committees and approvals. And, you know, and the Republicans are divided on this. You know, a couple Republican senators voted against it. So it's not easy to kind of corral all the votes that you need here. And, you know, on the administration side, there's a lot that the administration is trying to do right now. So there's certainly the rescissions packages they're working on and the work of DOGE, but they're cutting through regulation. They're trying to figure out, you know, all the different tangles in immigration. So there's a lot of balls in the air right now. And I recognize I'd love to see them move faster on the budget issues. And, but we have to recognize that they're doing a lot. I think, you know, I've heard Mike Johnson talk about how his plans for continuing to tackle budget. So you have the 12 appropriations bills that are coming up and then potentially another reconciliation bill in the fall. Again, they're not maybe as concerned as you and I are about the debt, but I think that they want to move in that direction and they just need to kind of garner the political will to do it.
I guess when I saw and the two Republicans, although I have to add alleged Republicans in my view, Collins and Murkowski, when they voted, oh no, we have to save $1 billion for public television and public radio. I've always had a negative attitude about that, and I've said it before. There was no reason in the world for America to have state-controlled media, unless, of course, we have an America that's like the old Soviet Union that had TASS, or China, Communist China, that has the Xinhua News Agency. Anybody thinks we need a government-funded, government-controlled media, better move to another country. Cuba, I hear, is nice this time of year. I just don't get it that these two can say, oh, no, you know, we're running ourselves into the ditch financially, but we've got to keep on funding public radio or public TV.
Well, I think you've identified a good retirement destination for Murkowski here. I totally hear you on that. And, you know, it's one thing with Collins in Maine where, you know, the state is pretty centrist, you know, kind of purplish. And so not clear how conservative can you get there. But Alaska, you know, there's really no excuse. You could get a much more conservative candidate elected there. But again, I agree with you on the broadcasting, right? We know that markets can provide it. Most news media outlets are privately owned and privately run and independent, and there's a lot of back and forth. And so there's no real market failure or gap or need that's being filled here. And as you know, the history of state media tends to always be pro-state, with all the problems that come with the state. And so I am not going to be shedding any tears over PBS and these other programs. having to go sing for their supper to the people who watch their shows and the people that they have to appeal to, the customers in the market.
Well, it's funny because they'll always, you know, the liberals will always tell you, if you say, I've got a study that says we can burn coal clean. And they say, oh, who paid for that? Probably the coal folks. And they'll always say the source of the money indicates the outcome of whatever it is. And that's their tried and true mantra. And then you say, oh, so if we have a public broadcasting system paid for by the government, it's going to be very pro-government. Oh, no, no, we're completely agnostic. You know, we present fair and balanced, even though we're getting $1 billion a year from the U.S. government. Somehow their standards change at that point, and I don't like that. You know, nor the idea that they say, well, if you're in a rural part of America, you can't get media. Paul, my wife and I love driving trips. We've been in some very rural areas. We've been in areas where you spin the dial, you can't get an AM or an FM radio station to save your life, but pull your phone out and you can stream any media you want from just about anywhere, literally on planet Earth. And I kind of get a kick out of it. I was thinking, I'm watching my radio scan through all the AM and FM bands and coming up with nothing, but coming off my phone is a stream of whatever I want to listen to out in the middle of nowhere. And then they're going to try and tell you there's somebody out in a log cabin somewhere and their only connection to society is through NPR. Please.
It's true. It would be as if, you know, 100 years ago they were talking about funding the Pony Express because we would never get mail or know what's going on if we lived in the western half of the country. But you're right about the source of the funding, too. And I think, you know, it's a mix of either naivete among some, but also I think on the left, the government embodies many of their values, right? Like top-down direction and bureaucracy and, you know, control over what people do. And so I think for them, the water feels fine. They're just used to it. But for those of us who don't share that view, we can just see it obviously that there's a skew here in terms of what's reported and the incentives in terms of how executives are putting together shows and hiring people. So, you know, I think you're right. And again, this is what's so good if we get this rescission bill through is I think for the first time, Republicans are showing, I think, the backbone to actually, you know, scale back some of this funding.
I wish we had, maybe we've got to get somebody like John Kennedy, one of the good Kennedys, the one from Louisiana, not the other ones, and get him to say, okay, I'm going to throw a bill a week out that is full of, you know, the most ridiculous stuff. I mean, stuff like what was in the USAID cuts, you know, transgender yep. opera for Serbia and, you know, and studies of left-handed underwater basket weaving and stuff like that. And just double dog dare his Republican colleagues here. Here's another package. Here's another $10 billion. Why don't we vote on this right now and have them say, right. Oh, no, no, John, go away. We don't want to. We've already done one. That was so much heavy lifting. We can't get anything else done. Paul, keep up the good work. Paul Mueller is an economist with the American Institute for Economic Research. We always appreciate his insights. In a moment, I'll get you your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Right now, we're...
Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. I got to mention this story. So you've got a guy who gets convicted because of the role he played in a bunch of the riots that happened in Portland. And he really didn't get that tough a punishment, but now all of a sudden a judge has decided, oh no, we've got to reduce the punishment for Darren Kimberlin. The reduced conviction literally means that this guy could ask for all of the charges to be set aside or expunged later on this year. This is how crazy it is. He was convicted for his role in anarchist riots in 2020 and 2021. Okay. and now he's getting the sentence. The Multnomah County DA's office says Judge Angela Lucero reduced the charges, and this happened a couple of days ago, against the 35-year-old Kimberlin. Officials said that Kimberlin took part in a series of anarchist riots. He vandalized the Democrat Party headquarters in southeast Portland. There was another incident where he vandalized a Chipotle, an Umpqua bank, and property that belonged to a security company. Now, they had this case going on. So November, about 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, Kimberlin pleads guilty to felony riot and criminal mischief charges. And then he accepted a sentence that included paying $50,000 in restitution, which is, I understand the case, Kimberlin's actually paid the money. So I'm not sure where an anarchist rioter, I don't know what his day job is, but he paid off the 50 grand. And now all of a sudden he gets the charges reduced almost anything from a Class C felony to a Class A misdemeanor. And that means he could have all of the charges wiped out and expunged later on. Now, the DA's office had dismissed other charges against Kimberlin back in 2022 when he pleaded guilty because they said, look, if he's going to plead to the felony, we'll dismiss the other charges. The reduction by Judge Lucero means that Kimberlin can ask for all the charges to be set aside or expunged. It will be as though he committed no crime at all. Now, if anybody thinks that is reasonable, I'd love to have the naysayer call. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists, Oregon Medical Centers. Let me go first to Russ. Hey, Russ, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Lars. I just wanted to, since we all have two ears and one mouth, but it seems like the Democrats, have two mouths and one ear. But anyway, when Pam Bondi came out about this Jeffrey Epstein case and she was, in front of the news, she had no time, at no time did she ever say that she had a list on her desk. What she said was, I have a directive on my desk that I'm going to go to. There is a clear difference between a directive and a list. And
she said file,
why
actually.
They want to take it.
Rush, she said file.
She said directive. If she said directive, and you can go back and look at it. And directive is clear difference.
Russ, she did refer to a file, and she said, I have the file sitting on my desk, and there's a directive to release it. And she said, after we've gone through it, let me tell you something. I call this constructive lying, and I'll tell you why. I hesitate to do that, but there are reasons I've distrusted Bondi from the start, even though she is Donald Trump's choice. If I ask you something, Russ, do you have, the money to pay for lunch? And you say, I have my wallet right here in my pocket. And you lead me to believe by the answer, because your answer doesn't say you have the money. You merely said you have your wallet in your pocket. You may know that your wallet is empty. You may know that your wallet is full. But if you think, if he's asking, do I have the money? And I say, I have my wallet right in my pocket. I'm implying that I have the money. Am I not?
Yeah.
So when she was asked, what about the Epstein files? Or what about the Epstein file? And she says, I have that folder, that, those documents on my desk, and there's a directive to release them. She led people to believe that she had the document when, in fact, she did not. Now, I don't know if she knew that at the time, but she gave everybody a reason to believe it was there. Do you believe, are you satisfied with the answers we're getting on Epstein right now and with the president's clear desire to move along?
I believe that there's a lot of things that get twisted out there.
I didn't ask you that. Are you satisfied with the answers we're getting?
Am I satisfied with the answers we're getting from the president? Only one, no. I mean, no, I just want to know one way or the other, clear, just like you do. But if somebody says they have a directive that they have to go over concerning that, then they should go over that directive. But to me, that's a directive, and yeah, it is.
All you're using is fancy semantics.
I understand.
Aren't you using semantics just to lie? because all you're saying is you're using a different word, knowing
that, way, yeah?
that when people are asking about, they want the list of names of the other people who got children for sex from Jeffrey Epstein. Now, that's what was asked about. When you give a deceptive answer, I don't like that. Trump promised transparency. Go ahead.
I'm not behind her. I don't like Pam Bondi all the way either. But what I was saying is she was pointing to a directive she had to go over, and then everything else got kind of pulled and twisted. And now everybody thinks there's some big... She never even alluded to what was in that file.
I disagree. She did allude to it. She was asked, are we going to get the Epstein client list? And she gave people reason to believe that we were, and now we're told it doesn't exist. And I don't buy it.
The Lars Larson Show.